I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Millions of American children and adults are overweight or obese. It's a relatively recent phenomenon that has serious and wide-ranging health and economic implications. There's been an ongoing discussion, even debate, about the cause of this problem. Do Americans eat too much? Does their diet include too many carbohydrates, too much fat? What about too much time in front of the computer or TV and not enough time being active or getting exercise? Gary Taubes, the author of Why We Get Fat, had a piece in the New York Times recently that caught our eye. It was about a new study with obese subjects published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that indicated that carbohydrates, not calories, were implicated in weight gain. We asked him to join us on Radio Times. He's a science journalist. His writing has appeared in a number of publications, including Discover Magazine and the New York Times Magazine. And Gary Taubes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
All right, thanks, Marnie.
We also asked Dr. Gary Foster to join us. He's been doing research on the prevention and treatment of obesity for more than 20 years. He's the director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University. He joins us in our Philadelphia studios. And Gary Foster, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let me go to you, Gary. Start with you. And what was significant about this research that you quoted in the New York Times? It was a study done at a university in Boston.
Well, this was one of a long line of studies that I've argued make the simple point that when you remove the carbohydrates from the diet, it's much easier to stay lean, and that implies that when you add carbohydrates, it's much easier to get fat. This particular study, they took obese subjects. They, in fact, semi-starved them to get them to lose 10 to 15% of their weight, and then they put them on one of three different diets. They alternated them through the diets, and one was the kind of low-fat, healthy-carb diet that we're told to eat by the American Heart Association and the USDA, among others, you know, fruits, vegetables, whole grains. One was what's called a low-glycemic index diet, where the carbohydrates in the diet, there's a little more fat, and the carbohydrates in the diet are much slower to digest. They have much less of an effect on blood sugar and insulin levels. And the third diet was effectively an Atkins-like diet, which is very low carbohydrate, virtually none, a lot of fat, a lot of protein. And what they found was even when they fed these people the same amount of calories, which was exactly equal to what they were expending in their weight-reduced state, they expended more energy. Their energy expenditure went up on the low-carb, high-fat diet, which is what you would expect if you take a sort of physiological, biological view of this problem. And, you know, you could argue that though all of us who are predisposed to be obese, who get fatter over the years, what we want to do is expend as much energy as possible with the diets that we're eating. And so the diet without carbohydrates would be the diet where we're expending the most energy per calorie consumed, which means we're storing the least as fat. And that's the sort of simplest I could make it in you know, this kind of venue. But that's the implication would be that, as I took away from it, that it's just another in a long line of research going back a century that would argue that what makes us fat is actually the macronutrient content of the diet, the carbohydrate content, not the total amount of calories expended or consumed.
Well, let me give you a chance, Gary Foster, and you know, we are doing kind of a Cliff Notes version of this particular research, but it highlights something I know that Gary Taubes has been writing about and believes in, which is that it's the carbohydrates in our diet that are the problem. What's your response?
I think first that it's a very elegantly done study by David Ludwig and his colleagues. No study's perfect. It's, you know, 21 patients, looked at a variety of different diets. Actually, the weights were similar across groups. So the increased energy expenditure didn't seem to have an effect, at least for a short period of time. But I think it's a really interesting study, and, you know, I think the jury's out on all the different nuances of how different diets can affect things. I think the bottom line perspective is that there's an overwhelming body of research, and this is largely done in inpatient metabolic wards, which are really important to figure out this question. Right. Is it calories, is it carbs, is it fat, is it protein? You put people in basically a locked environment, you measure carefully their movement, their energy expenditure, and what they eat. Those kind of studies have, I think, consistently shown that it's calories in and calories out. That's what drives weight loss, even in inpatient metabolic ward studies where you can look at a low-carb diet. And in fact, people prescribed a low-carb diet lose more weight, but it's because they consume fewer calories. So I think that's a simpler, more basic explanation for why low-carb diets may be effective, more effective for some than others.
Well, so, and just to get to the bottom line, you're saying that essentially all calories are equal.
I think when it comes to weight loss, I think when you talk about the effects on cholesterol, you talk about the effects on lots of other endpoints. That's a much more open question. I think there are actually reasonable data to say a low-carbohydrate diet, for example, has great effects on good cholesterol. But when it comes to weight loss, it's hard to argue the data in a controlled environment that your weight loss is going to be directly proportional to that energy deficit. That is the difference between what you eat and what you burn.
Actually,
go ahead, Gary.
Mari, can I
please
put the context of this for you?
Sure.
And for Dr. Foster. There's basically two ways to look at this. The way we've perceived in the U.S. since the 1950s is that obesity is what, you know, Dr. Foster would call an energy balance problem. So, you know, it's basically about the if you consume more calories than you expend, the excess calories are going to get stuck in your fat tissue, and that's effectively why we get fat. So we're either eating too much or expending too little. And, you know, what he's saying is when you do these studies, you'll see if people lose weight one way or the other. They eat less calories. They tend to eat less calories, and that's why the weight comes off. The alternative hypothesis, the alternative argument, which was actually how the German and Austrian researchers perceived this problem prior to the Second World War. One of the advantages I had as a journalist was I got to spend 5 years going back through all this research. So the way the Europeans perceived it prior to World War II was that obesity was a hormonal defect, a regulatory defect, not this eating too much, exercising too little, which are behavioral issues. They just said, you know, there's something wrong with the fat tissue, that it's accumulating too much fat. We know that the whole human body is regulated by hormones and enzymes and other factors. And if we figure out what regulates fat accumulation, we'll understand the cause of human obesity. And they said, it's silly to believe in this sort of calories issue, because if some hormone makes you grow fatter, you're going to take in more calories than you expend. And one of the metaphors they used was growing children. You know, when children go through growth spurts, they eat voraciously, and they, you know, they lie around the house all day long, and they take in more energy than they expend. They're in, you know, what the researchers call positive energy balance, but they're not growing because they're eating so much. They're eating so much because they're growing, and the growth is caused by specific hormones, growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor. So the pre-World War II Europeans were making this argument about obesity. Sure, if somebody gets fatter, they're going to want to eat more. But they're not going to get fatter because they eat more. They're going to want to eat more because they're getting fatter. So it's the causality is reversed. And the argument since then, in the 1960s, we learned that the hormone insulin controls fat accumulation. Carbohydrates, for all intents and purposes, the sugars and grains in the diet pretty much control your insulin levels. And so the idea is now, you know, when Dr. Foster says, for instance, in studies, you can show that people are losing weight when they even on a low-carb diet, they eat less. The argument would be the reason they eat less is because they're secreting less insulin, they're mobilizing fat from their fat tissue, they're burning that fat, and so they're not as hungry because they're actually burning the fat that they've stored, which is what their fat's there. So instead of actually, again, you reverse the causality, instead of actually losing weight because they're eating less because they're losing weight. And the challenge of science, the real challenge here is to determine which of these causal pathways is the correct one.
Well,
do they lose weight because they eat less, or do they eat less because they've changed the hormonal regulation of their fat tissue, and now they're burning their own fat when before it was locked up in their fat and they couldn't access it.
Okay, fair. Let me just jump in here and let me ask a really basic question. I'll go to you, Gary Foster. It appears that the problem of obesity and overweight Americans started a couple of decades ago. What do you think has been the trigger for the fact that we have so many people in this country with weight problems?
I think the probably the biggest factor on the intake side would be increase in portion sizes, and this is increase in portion sizes of every food and drink. It's just ubiquitous, and it's very almost linear and parallel.
We're literally eating more food.
So, you know, a candy bar is now a bigger candy bar. A sugar-sweetened beverage is now bigger. A cookie is now bigger. Everything is bigger, healthy, unhealthy. They're all bigger. And there's some regression backwards, so I think some of the portion sizes are changing in the good direction. But I think that's a very simple explanation. I think, to Gary's point, that, you know, scientists could argue for a long time about the direction of causality and what's the physiological driver. I think the practical point is, from a public health message, what do we want to tell people in the context of an obesity epidemic? Is it eat less of certain types of foods? Is it at least eat less or of all food? And I think the simple, most direct, not easy to do, by the way, but simple, is whatever you're eating, if you ate less of it, you would lose weight. It's just hard to refute the data that, independent of the type of diet you consume, if you consume less of that diet, you will in fact lose weight. We could, you know, debate a lot about what the mechanisms are, but I think that's the clinical reality.
But are you talking about calories then? I mean, yes, it's consuming less.
At the end of the day, it's a calorie game. Right. And I think in some ways this gives consumers a lot of freedom. So if you're particularly inclined or attracted to a low-carb approach, go for it. High protein, go for it. Low fat, go for it. All of those are at the service of decreasing calories.
Let me go back to you, Gary, and talk about carbohydrates. From your perspective, from the research that you've done, is there a difference? Does the body see a plate of brown rice different from a bowl of potato chips?
Well,
go ahead, Gary.
Let me phrase this question a little bit differently. With one of the things I do in my book, Why We Get Fat, that I would have hoped the obesity research community would have done. For instance, I start the book with an anecdote from 1933, which is a young German physician named Hilde Bruck came to the United States in 33. In 1934, she moved to Manhattan, and she was struck. She writes in her memoir, she was struck by how fat the kids were in New York in 1934, which was the very heart of the Depression. And said, not just chubby kids, roly-poly fat kids. And Hilde Bruck actually then started the first pediatric obesity clinic in the United States. It was at Columbia University. And Dr. Bruck went on to be the leading expert on pediatric obesity in the mid-20th century. And the point is, where, you know, Dr. Foster is blaming the latest surge in obesity on portion sizes and eating more. But you can go back historically, and I do this in the very first chapter of Why We Get Fat, and find populations, like at the heart of the Depression, 40% of the workforce was out of work. This was the era of soup kitchens and bread lines. So why were the kids then so fat?
But let me stop you there, and we're almost up in a break, but are you saying that there was an equal problem of overweight Americans back in the 30s as there is today?
It's not equal. But there were plenty of obese children in the 1930s in the heart of the Depression. No TVs, no computers, you know, poverty rife, and yet high levels of obesity. And there were a host of other populations that I discussed, about a dozen other populations, beginning with the Native American tribe, the Pima in Arizona in 1902, and Sioux living on a reservation in South Dakota in 1928.
And Gary,
extremely poor populations. Very high levels of obesity.
We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about calories and carbohydrates and fat with Gary Taubes and Dr. Gary Foster, and we'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view now through September 30th, Dive Deep, Eric Fischel and the Process of Painting. Major works by internationally acclaimed artist Eric Fischel, known for his representational work focusing on the American suburban experience and the language of human bodies. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org. pafa.org.
An unseen danger of urban growing is the risk of lead contamination in your dirt. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do when Superman can't see through your soil. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Yeah. Filmmaker Rodrigo Cortés's newest project follows two investigators as they try to debunk theories about paranormal activities. And get ready, the director says he has some tricks to keep you guessing.
Magic and filmmaking, in a way, are exactly the same things.
We talk about the film Red Lights, starring Sigourney Weaver and Robert De Niro, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are, I guess, deconstructing calories and carbs and fat, talking about healthy eating and what it takes to eat right, but also learning some of the interesting and sometimes contradictory research about things like carbohydrates and fats. Talking with Gary Foster, director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University. He's been doing research for more than two decades, and joining us by telephone, Gary Taubes. He's a science journalist. His writing has appeared in a number of publications. He's also the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Gary, let me just come back at you, and I'd like to hear what Gary Foster has to say as well. This is to you, Gary Taubes, which is this notion of carbohydrates, whether it's a bowl of brown rice, a bowl of potato chips, a bowl of apples. Does the body, metabolize or ingest that or experience that or use that differently?
Well, yes, the answer is yes. But let me just to finish the point I was making before the break. You can find in literature a dozen extremely poor populations, some of which do have obesity levels similar to what we have in the United States today. Some of them were barely, the malnutrition and undernutrition in the children, this observation of obese mothers with starving children. And when you look at these kinds of populations, it's hard to argue that the reason they're getting fat is because they eat too much. Some of them were extremely hard-working populations, Mexican-American oil field laborers in a study done in 1981 in Starr County, Texas, or Chilean construction workers in a study in 1960. And so the argument back then was that it wasn't this quantity of calories, it was the quality, and that obesity is a kind of malnutrition, not overnutrition, and that if you get too many carbohydrates, and particularly sugars, that drives a certain hormonal response in the body. And so, the argument that I've been making and is that, yes, every nutrient, and instead of saying a bowl of potato chips versus a bowl of brown rice, you could start with a bowl of brown rice, for instance, versus a bowl of olive oil or a piece of, fatty meat. So it's carbohydrates versus fat or carbohydrates versus protein and fat. And each one of these nutrients has a dramatically different effect on the hormones that regulate fat accumulation. So carbohydrates, and particularly the refined grains and sugars, dramatically affect insulin levels. And the hormone insulin has been known since 1960 or so to be the hormone that primarily causes fat accumulation in fat cells. Protein stimulates a little bit of insulin, but it also stimulates counter-regulatory hormones, like one is called glucagon. And fat doesn't do any of that. So if you just look at obesity is a fat accumulation problem, and ask the question, what regulates the fat tissue, which is the way the pre-World War II Europeans looked at it, then you would answer the question, well, it's the carbohydrates that make you fat. And until the 1960s, fascinatingly enough, the conventional wisdom was that carbohydrates were fattening. And I have a whole chapter in my book on this history, but one of my favorite lines was a 1963 British Journal of Nutrition article written by one of the two leading British dietitians. The first sentence was, every woman knows that carbohydrates are fattening. And every woman did. And then we got scared about dietary fat as a cause of heart disease. And from the 1960s and 1980s, we transformed this concept of a fattening carbohydrate into the heart-healthy carbohydrate that we all eat today. And this happens to coincide with the obesity epidemic.
Okay, let me give Gary Foster a chance to respond to that.
Just to clarify an earlier point, I think it's probably too simple and perhaps runs the risk of being accusatory to people who struggle with their weight to say it's simply you eat too much, as if it's their fault. So this is not a fair fight. So there's a lot of biology involved that Gary has alluded to. So I think the answer is relatively simple in terms of calories in and calories out, but the factors that affect that and what happens when you gain weight and lose weight is really complicated, and embarrassingly don't know as much as we should in the field of obesity research. I think the reality is, though, if you eat a high carbohydrate diet, and you eat less of that high carbohydrate diet, all of these regulatory mechanisms that Gary describes, your insulin goes down. It's not that your insulin goes up. You know, if you're in an energy deficit, you get impressive metabolic benefits independent of macronutrient composition, that is fat, carbohydrate, or protein. And again, I think we could disagree around the fringes about if you eat a low-carb diet, what's the advantage on triglycerides or the good cholesterol. But if weight loss, to put it very simply from a public health point of view, in the context of an obesity epidemic, I think we do a disservice to get people to chase 35 things, not just fiber, but soluble and insoluble, not just fat, but the types of fat, not just carbs, but the types of carbs. That's a very tough message for most folks to get and, more importantly, to adhere to. And I think at the end of the day, calories count.
Well, and I want to just throw something back at you, Gary Foster, I'm neither a scientist nor a researcher like yourself or a science journalist, but pulling out just sugar and, let's say, high fructose corn syrup, which seems to be added to almost everything that we eat that's certainly store-bought, how much is that part of our diet, the fact that we have so much sugar in our diet? How much do you think that that's been one of the reasons why so many people are overweight?
I think it could add, I'm not so sure about the high fructose corn syrup from a biochemical point of view, but if something tastes good, so high fat, high sugar foods were, from an evolutionary point of view, programmed to like those foods. If foods taste good, we're likely to eat more of them. So I think that's the reality. High fructose corn syrup, from a calorie point of view, isn't any different than any other type of sugar. If it's added, if it's not added, calories are calories. And I think, again, we could get, I think, distracted in a very significant way to start to chase. And there are kernels of truth in science about all of these different components, that this could be harmful, that could be harmful. But at the end of the day, what's the message to the public who's struggling with their weight? It's to watch calories. And what those calories consist of, I wouldn't say is unimportant, but is less important than the total number of calories.
And you think the public gets overwhelmed by either the information or there's a new study that says do X, Y, and Z?
I think both things are true. One is that there's a lot of data that come out on a daily basis now and gets well covered about do this, don't do that, this is harmful, this isn't. But even in clinical settings, and even in guidelines, we hear things like, okay, count calories. That's what we tell our patients. Okay, what else do I have to do? Well, you have to count fat. Well, how's that work? Well, 30%. As soon as you say 30%, you've lost a certain percentage of the population. Now you have to convert calories to grams. Now you have to worry about sodium. Now you have to worry about the type of fat, fiber. It's really the things we ask people to go through to decide what to have for lunch is overwhelming. And I think, you know, keep it simple really does apply here.
What do you think, Gary Taubes? And then we'll get to our callers. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, certainly keeping it simple is important. But the question is, do you want it to be simple and right? And the idea we've been telling people, obese people have known for a century, that this idea that they should eat less if they're fat, and in fact, again, quoting these, you know, these pre-World War II Europeans, they used to say, look, we could define obesity as what the people who are obese are the ones for whom eating less fails, because everyone knows they should eat less. They start getting fatter, you try to eat, and we've all gone through this in life, those of us with weight problems, we've all tried to eat less, we've all tried to exercise more. There's this heartbreaking short story in the 1960s called The Fat Girl, and it's just about this endless struggle of this woman, this young girl, to eat less, to satisfy her parents. Obesity is a terrible burden psychologically and physically, and obese subjects, obese individuals, you know, try far harder than lean people to do what they're told, and it fails. So the question is, what's the correct simple advice?
Yeah.
And the idea that carbohydrates are fattening, if it's right, is also simple. In the same way cigarettes cause lung cancer, you don't want lung cancer, don't smoke. Carbohydrates make you fat. You don't want to be fat, you don't eat foods that are carbohydrate rich. And to give you an example of how it gets complicated, You know, Dr. Foster himself did one of the largest, perhaps the largest study ever done on comparing a low-fat diet to a low-carbohydrate diet. This is a sort of American Heart Association diet compared to an Atkins diet, and simplistically speaking. And so for the Atkins diet, the advice they give people is stay away from carbohydrates, eat as much fat and protein as you want, eat as much as you want. It's what technically called an ad libitum diet. You can eat as much as you want. For the low-fat diet, they say, you know, you're restricting fat, you're restricting carbohydrates, you're restricting protein, and you're restricting all calories. So they're trying to hit, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Foster, 1,500 to 1,800 calories a day versus a diet where you're allowed to eat as much as you want, as long as you don't eat carbohydrates. So they're both relatively simple instructions.
Right.
Both require some sacrifice. One requires, you know, consciously trying to restrict how much you eat, and the other one doesn't.
And
the question is, why is it when you give this Atkins, this you know, high-fat protein diet without carbohydrates, why do people eat less? Even when they're not told to, and they don't have to. Now, remember, obese people their whole lives are struggling with this problem. They're trying to eat less. They're trying to exercise. Right. And yet, suddenly, you take the carbohydrates out of the diet, say you can eat as much as you want, and it becomes relatively easy for them
to
eat less.
Well, let me give the author of that study, Gary Foster, a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Gary.
I think it's a very interesting question that Gary raises about if you tell people to count calories and you tell people to count carbs, at least in short-term studies, that people who count carbs actually consume fewer calories. But that's a short-term, and not very short-term, 3-6 months long, that's the phenomenon. But our study that Gary talks about and others have shown that over the long term, two-year studies, several hundred patients, some studies longer than that, or not longer than that, but bigger than that, actually, so there's no difference. And that, I guess, supports my point of view in that if it's about calories at the end of the day, and again, no study is perfect, and these are outpatient studies. They're not in a metabolic ward. We're not examining exactly what they're eating. But there are a lot of ways to get to the end point of weight loss. And it seems, again, to me misguided and maybe complicated. I take Gary's point about it not just has to be simple but correct, and I think correct means supported by data, supported by randomized trials in the real world and in the metabolic ward. And I think it's overwhelmingly clear that metabolic ward data, very controlled, very short-term studies, lots of metabolic measurements, as well as real-world two-year studies in several hundred people show the same thing over and over again. Cutting calories leads to weight loss, and how you mix up those calories doesn't have an effect.
Gary Tubbs, just very briefly, because we've got a lot of callers, and we're a little bit in the weeds, but I know the weeds is sort of where the science is, and I appreciate that. But go ahead, Gary Tubbs.
Well, here's the fact. You know, again, Dr. Foster and I come, he's coming from this from more of a clinical perspective, and again, I hope I'm not oversimplifying this, but I'm, despite being a journalist, I'm coming at it from more of a scientific perspective. So the way I see it is, you know, they compare one diet where the instruction is restrict calories, and one diet where the instruction is not eat as much as you want. If you just look at it from that simplistic perspective, and then after 6 months, a year, whatever, they get roughly the same amount of weight loss. Then you could argue, what do the calories have to do with it? Why even tell people to eat less? If when you don't tell them to eat less, when you tell them to eat as much as you want but eat less carbs, you get the same weight loss. So just from that perspective. Now, the reason I would argue they get the same weight loss are compliance issues. People don't stay on these diets and these trials. So you don't actually know what the effect of calories versus carbohydrates is. And it's one argument for doing, you know, Dr. Foster has talked about metabolic ward studies.
Right.
We've actually reviewed 90 years of history of these studies. They're not at all conclusive, and we're in the process of putting together and actually funding research. This is a not-for-profit we've founded to fund the kinds of studies that I think Dr. Foster would agree would be definitive. But simply put, when you compare a calorie-restricted diet to a diet where you get to eat as much as you want, and the weight loss is roughly equivalent, then you simply ask the question, Okay. Why to, you know, what do the calories have to do with it?
Well, it's a fair question. I'm sorry to our callers. Go ahead, Gary Foster.
I think the only way you can answer that, Gary, is to put people in a metabolic ward, and Gunther Bowden at Temple has done that. So he had
for two weeks.
Correct. Well, you can't put people in metabolic. You can't argue it both ways, right? You can't say the long-term studies are flawed because of non-adherence, and then when you cite controlled metabolic data, say it's only 2 weeks. I think
well,
to my earlier point,
I mean
to my earlier point,
you can't argue that they're both flawed. They are both flawed.
Agreed, but we can't.
How do we do them right?
Well,
so
I don't.
5 years from now, we have nothing to argue.
Hold
about.
On, Gary Tops. Go ahead, Gary Foster.
I don't think we'll ever be in that position, frankly, Gary, where we can get the perfect study. I think certain mechanistic studies about, to your question about how is it that people do this or do that when they're given this instruction, has to be answered in a metabolic ward study. If you want to look at the effects of when you tell people to do something, how does that play out in the real world? Right. That's another sort of study. We probably just can agree to disagree that the literature, what the literature says, but the literature is, in my mind, overwhelmingly compelling in that it's calories that count in a controlled environment. Once you get to the real world, it's tough going.
Well, Gary Foster, let me ask you, though, and just picking up on the Atkins diet, which is, of course, you know, high protein, high fat, and as Gary Taub said, you're allowed to eat anything you want. Are people less hungry on that particular diet? Do they experience less hunger because they have all that protein and essentially fat within their system?
We haven't found that in our studies. I think, and just the one point of clarity, it's not that they can eat whatever they want. The instructions were to consume carbohydrates limited to 3 cups of green leafy vegetables, right, and they should eat till they're satisfied, not stuffed, which is a little different than sort of eat whatever you want, whenever you want. And so, you know, why that happens is unclear. Again, that's a metabolic ward study. And it could be that the structure of the diet, mm-hmm, where you take out a large chunk of the of a typical American's dietary intake is carb, maybe it's that restriction, both of carbs and calories, that makes a difference. We could post hoc speculate for a long time,
sure,
about what the mechanism is, but the reality is, I think from a calorie perspective, that's the thing to focus in on.
And to you, Gary Taubes, and we're about a minute away from our second break here, I should say, it is true that most people that are overweight and go on diets struggle with the diet. I mean, it seems even with Atkins, and I know people that have been on Atkins, they struggle with that as well. I mean, it seems like it's hard to stay on a diet.
It's definitely hard to stay. But again, you're looking at two different issues. One is sort of restricting calories. You could think of it as, it used to be referred to as semi-starving yourself. And nobody can do that. Lean people can't do that. Obese people can't do that. Ansel Keys showed this famously in a series of studies during the Second World War, where you just cut people's calories in half. They're hungry all the time. They're angry. They're depressed. They're enervated. If they have the opportunity to eat, they will. That's the calorie-restricted version.
Right.
The carbohydrate-restricted version, the Atkins-type thing, yeah, people crave carbohydrates. I would argue the reason they crave them is because of their effect on their fat tissue. That's obviously open to debate. But there, the model would be more like cigarette smoking. It's something that is indeed, carbohydrates are indeed addictive. There's no such thing as an essential carbohydrate that we have to eat, and that if people could break that addiction, if they understood why, they fundamentally understood what was happening in their bodies, which is what I try to do in my books, then they would see, look, these are just foods I can't eat. Yeah, I have a colleague who says, I have to go to a restaurant where I don't get foods I'm allergic to. And you say, what are you allergic to? And he says, I'm allergic to carbohydrates. They make me fat.
Okay, well, hold on, only because we are taking that second break. Gary Taubes and Gary Foster, our guests today on Radio Times. And we will take callers after this very short break, I promise. We'll be right back.
Pico Pops at the Man presents Chris Botti in concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Thursday evening, July 19th. As a jazz instrumental artist, Botti's success has crossed over to audiences usually reserved for pop music, and his ongoing association with PBS has led to 4 number one jazz albums and multiple gold, platinum, and Grammy awards. Tickets are available at mancenter.org or 215-893-1999. The Man supports WHYY.
This land is your land.
This Saturday marks the centennial of Woody Guthrie's birth. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his life and music with Jeff Place, who co-produced a new Guthrie box set and co-wrote the companion book, and Ed Cray, who wrote a biography of Guthrie called Ramblin' Man that's published in a new edition. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Texas is in a battle with the Justice Department over its new voter ID laws. Where do other state laws stand? Also, Penn State releases what's expected to be a blockbuster report on what Penn State officials knew and when they knew it. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
We are talking about calories, carbs, and fat today on Radio Times with two Garys. Gary Taubes joining us by telephone. He's a science journalist, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. And Gary Foster here in our Philadelphia studios. He's director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University. And we do have a full bank of callers here. So I do want to get some callers in. It looks like we have Pam from Audubon joining us on Radio Times. And Pam, go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say I wish that parents would, you know, take more of a role in what their children are eating. I am a manager for an elementary school cafeteria, and the government's come in, and there's all these regulations about their tray, and they must have three things on their tray, but not more than five components, whereas a chicken nugget counts as two components. A French fry would be a third component, and they can only choose one fruit or one vegetable, and their milk is yet another component. They're not allowed to have water unless they get a note from a doctor in place of the milk. How about, you know, the government giving us more money to hire people like it was when I was a little girl to come in and cook some real food for these kids?
Well, I have a feeling both of our guests would probably agree with that, Pam. Let me give Gary Foster a chance to weigh in. And we have done whole shows about school cafeterias.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work over the last decade in Philadelphia and nationally about trying to do things school-based. And I think that there are a lot of complexities in terms of the regulations. I think there's this natural tension between the co-occurrence of both obesity and food insecurity. So on the one hand, a lot of these policies were driven by kids being very poor and not having enough to eat. So when there tends to be, again, this natural tension between obesity advocates who want to cut calories and hunger advocates, and they can often happen in the same kid in the same family. You know, some days of the month you might not get any food or not know where it's coming from, but you still may be 150 pounds at age 10. So it's a really tough political issue when it comes to policy. And, yeah. But I think the USDA has done some moves in the right direction by cutting the maximum or the minimum number of calories in breakfast and lunch that'll take effect this year or next.
What do you think, Gary Taubes? We'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, I basically agree. I just want to point out that, you know, this association that Dr. Foster talked about, food insecurity, poverty, and obesity, is again an argument against this idea that these kids get fat because they eat too much. You know, if they're not getting enough food many days of the month, some days of the month, that it's hard to imagine that they're simply eating more than lean children.
And we've done whole shows about that. Let me get to, it looks like Laura from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Laura, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that I'm having success losing weight Dr. Foster's way with calorie reduction and walking. And the calorie reduction has been really helped by using iPhone apps that help you log your food and calculate your calories. It makes it really simple. And I'm really skeptical of the carb theory. I lived in Southeast Asia for 5 years, where they eat the balance of their diet is white rice or white rice noodles, often with added sugar, and they're very small framed and quite lean.
Well, Laura, let me give Gary Taubes a chance to respond to that. What do you say, Gary?
Well, two things. When you actually look at the sugar consumption of Southeast Asian populations, they consume about the amount of sugar per capita that we consumed in the U.S. back in the 1870s. So, again, yes, they have rice and other grains, but if you just look at the sugar consumption, and the sort of fundamental argument here is that it's quite likely sugars, by which means sucrose and high fructose corn syrup, that cause a condition called insulin resistance. And there's a lot of evidence to argue for this lately. And once you're insulin resistant, all the carbs become problematic. The second issue is even Dr. Foster's way, calorie counting, when you restrict the calories you consume significantly, you restrict the carbohydrates you consume because they make up the bulk of the diet, usually 50 to 55% of the calories, and you improve the quality of the carbohydrates you consume. So you get rid of sweets, you get rid of sodas and drink water instead. So instead of sugar-sweetened beverages, you're consuming water. If you're a beer drinker, you switch to light beer. You can think of it as counting calories, but you're also counting carbs. You're also getting rid of the most offensive carbohydrates. So again, from the scientific perspective, the question is, which of those two is having the effect? And if you were to eat a diet that only restricted carbohydrates and allowed you to eat fat and protein as much as you wanted, would you have better effect, and would it be easier? And that's the problem with these sort of anecdotal observations, is you don't have your own experience to compare it with. If you had gone from an Atkins diet and say where you were gaining weight and suddenly switched to a more carb-rich diet where you're just restricting calories and now you're losing weight, that would be a significant observation.
Okay. Laura, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you want to respond to what he just said? He said when you're cutting calories, you end up cutting carbs.
That's right, and I think when you cut carbs, you end up cutting calories. It's one of these arguments that could go on forever, and I don't think, again, we're going to tease that out short of a very controlled study. I just want to clarify that that I'm not advocating that people, the only way to do this is to count calories. What I'm saying is the only way to effectively lose weight is to cut calories. So you may cut calories by going on an Atkins diet. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said this, but we've done large randomized trials. There are over 10 now that says it's a very viable alternative. So I don't have a horse in this race. I'm not trying to promote Atkins or bash Atkins. My point is whatever diet you use, and I think this gives some latitude to the public, as long as it cuts calories and you can wrap your mind around that, do it. And pay attention to tracking, pay attention to weighing yourself regularly. Those are the behavioral things that we know that work.
But just picking up on that, if someone has, you know, steak and eggs for breakfast, steak for lunch, hamburgers for dinner, they would end up cutting their calories. I mean, chances are that would be a semi, not low calorie, but they would have probably reduced their calories.
Yeah, in our studies, what happens is, and this is more anecdote than data, that people for right. 2-3 days, maybe even 2-3 weeks, tend to overconsume because they can. And after a while, it just gets to be monotonous. And right. then they eventually reduce their intake. Again, I take Gary's point about that it may be easier, at least in the short term. It's simpler. They may be less hungry. Our data don't say that. But I guess what I want to be clear is I'm not suggesting there's only one way to do this. I think the common endpoint has to be a reduction in energy intake, that is calories. But you could do this in a variety of different ways.
And something that fits your lifestyle and your
exactly.
Gary Talbot, anything you want to add to that? We'll get back to our
phone. Well, and it's an interest. It's as though you're dealing with two different paradigms. I would say if you want to lose weight, you have to change the regulation of your fat tissue, the way your body regulates your fat tissue. And the way you do that is by restricting the carbohydrates. So now, as Dr. Foster said, you know, if you restrict carbohydrates, you might restrict calories as well.
Right.
And in general, people restrict calories. But the reason they lose weight is because they're restricting carbohydrates, lowering their insulin levels, changing the regulation of their fat tissue. And when you do that, you start releasing fat from the fat tissue and burning it for fuel. And so it's a much more biological viewpoint. And the reason, again, I keep arguing for more and better science here, as I did in my New York Times op-ed, is because while we've been giving this eat less, exercise more advice, we have experienced an obesity epidemic. And so the argument is maybe the advice is just wrong.
Mm.
And if we had been giving the right advice, if what we believed in the 1960s, we had continued to believe that carbohydrates had this unique characteristic that made them increase your fat accumulation, perhaps we would have never seen this obesity epidemic.
All right, let me get
And so continuing to say what we've been saying for 40, 50 years, when the problem gets worse and worse around you. I mean, some people have defined that as the definition of insanity is to continue to do what you've always done, even as things get worse and worse.
Well, let me just jump in here only because we do have a lot of callers, including Ralph from media, joining our conversation. And Ralph, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm curious to hear Gary's take on the most recent MyPlate recommendations from the government. And also, I have three young active boys. And should I be restricting their carbohydrate intake? And if so, what kind of carbs should I be restricting?
And Ralph, are they overweight?
They are not.
They're not. Well, let me go to. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Gary. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, okay, let me.
I'm sorry. I think that's a bad phone line. Actually, let me put that to you, Gary Foster. I mean, if you're not overweight, is there anything you should do differently with your diet?
No, I think in some ways it gives you more latitude to focus on the quality across the nutritional profile, right? So you could pay attention to a lot of different things. My pyramid or my plate is a good example of that. And again, I think it's generally good advice. I think, again, where it gets very complicated is people overthink it. And there are so many guidelines to follow that it just gets to be analysis paralysis and people can't do much. In terms of, you know, really taking a whole group of anything out of a child's diet, I think balance, you know, keep, you know, a variety of foods in the house, give kids some choice, but their choices are among healthy items. And we probably could get some disagreement about what healthy is. But in general, I think that my plate, to answer your question, is a reasonable place to start. My only argument would be there's a lot of targets, but that's what policy is about, right? They have to hit every shortfall nutrient in the country. There's a lot of thinking that goes behind that. The practice behind it's quite difficult.
Gary Taubes?
Yeah, Again, one of the arguments I've been making in my book is that, you know, we should effectively eat the diet we've evolved to eat. Simplest way to put it, you know, the 2 million years that we've been hunter-gatherers before agriculture and then the Industrial Revolution, the refinement of sugar and other carbs. And so the argument, these discussions tend to digress into arguments about what's the best diet to lose weight. The argument is fundamentally, again, my book is called Why We Get Fat for a Reason. It's about literally the cause of obesity. You know, many of us today, I would say most obese individuals today, and we know this just from the obesity epidemic, were lean, active children at one point in our lives. And we didn't have weight problems. I mean, some did, but most didn't. And then at some point, our bodies shift, and the question is, what causes that shift? And so the argument I would make is, you know, one way or the other, and the argument I make in my book is that anyone can benefit, even lean, healthy children will benefit if they cut dramatically the amount of sugars and refined grains they're consuming. So they could still eat less refined grains, green vegetables, tubers, but the sugars and the white bread do no one any favor.
No, fair enough. And is there some agreement on that, Gary Foster?
I would be much more concerned about what we call with kids red foods or less foods in terms of high-fat foods, high-sugar foods, high-calorie foods. Whether I would get into a tug-of-war about white bread, probably not.
Okay. Fair enough. I thought there might be some agreement here, but I was wrong
now
on that
sugar.
One.
Sugar. How about that? Would you get in a tug-of-war over sugar?
Yeah, how about sugar?
From an oral health point of view, I think it's a really important thing to pay attention to. I'm not sure from an obesity point of view that it's a game changer.
Let me ask, actually put this to you, Gary Foster, which is I was reading, and you know it's always dangerous reading about health and a diet, but that the obesity epidemic, as we call it, has plateaued in the United States. Is there some evidence of that?
There is. It's sort of tough data to interpret because they're cross-sectional studies, so it's not following the same people over time. But if they say do a nationally representative sample, it looks like it's plateauing, and encouragingly so in children as well. Why that is, you know, is it that there's, if you, quote, blame the environment or the food supply for what's happened over the last 30 years, something must have changed. And I think from a research perspective, it would be good to figure out what that is. The answer is it's probably not one thing. It's probably a combination of things, increased awareness, maybe some changes to the food supply. It's tough to know, but it's a good sign. We still shouldn't celebrate that we have over 65% of this country at least overweight, and we shouldn't celebrate that we have, you know, high teens rates of childhood obesity, but at least it's not increasing.
Let me get Nicole from Princeton to join our conversation. And Nicole, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to agree with Dr. Foster about the calorie issue, that it is important to track calories if you're, whether you're losing weight or even maintaining weight, because I think maintaining weight is actually harder. But I'm mostly in agreement with Gary Taubes about the issue of the refined carbohydrates. I just think that our food supply is so heavily laden down with these things, the cereals and the breads and everything. You can't find a simple bread anymore, with just made with whole wheat flour and salt and flour and salt and water. It's got to have, you know, 50 other things in it. And I have found definitely in my own experience with weight that it is much easier to cut calories if and not feel hungry all the time if I'm not eating loads and loads and loads of starchy, refined carbs.
I hear you.
I think it's much easier
to
eat more veg and fruits and whole foods. You know, that's where I think we ought to be going. And
okay,
not,
fair enough. Nicole, thanks for calling in. Let me give Gary Taubes. Gary, you have about a minute before we have to end our discussion. I'd be curious what you say back to Nicole.
Well, and I'll bring that back to the populations I talked about in the beginning of the interview, and these incredibly poor populations pre-1980, going back to 1902, where you had high levels of obesity, particularly in the women. And these were not populations where they could eat too much. These were populations where the environment counted their calories for them, limited the amount of food available. In some cases, we know this because their children were starving. And yet there were still high levels of obesity. And so you ask the question, what did they have that we have that could have caused obesity in both of us? And here's where our Princeton caller nailed it, which is the refined grains and sugars.
Mm.
So the idea is you add refined grains and sugars to the diet, they literally make your fat tissue want to store fat as calories. That's why people are hungrier when they eat them. That's why people eat more. And if you remove these from the diet, and again, this is a scientific issue that I hope Dr. Foster and I will talk about later off the air, because I think we have some studies that we're going to fund that he'll find fascinating and may even want to be involved with. But this is a scientific issue. If we could solve this scientific issue, we can begin to give people exactly the right advice instead of perhaps advice that works but works indirectly because it touches on the right advice.
Well, on that note, I have to jump in here and we'll see if you two hook up after the show or not. Gary Taubes, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Gary Foster, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Very interesting conversation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. And chances in you'd like to weigh in on our Facebook conversation. Michaela Cross and Jared Brausch are interns this summer, and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us. And coming